all to say to me. The fate of others must never count for anything when our well-being is at stake. We shall be saved, that's certain. Four men, my friends and accomplices, will join us, and I guarantee that you will be set free.
I tell you, madame, the same divine hand that has just punished my innocence now served my protector's criminal intentions. The place caught fire with horrendous consequences, with 21 people burnt alive. But we escaped. That same day, we reached the cottage of a poacher in the forest of Bondi, an intimate friend of our gang.
Now that you're free, Thérèse,
Dubois then said to me,
you can choose any path through life you please, but I have one piece of advice to give you, and that is to abandon the path of virtue, which, as you can see, has never brought you success. A misplaced delicacy led you to the foot of the scaffold, whereas an awful crime saved me from it. Look where good deeds get you in this world. Is it really worth sacrificing yourself for them? You are young and pretty, Thérèse. Give me 2 years and I guarantee to make your fortune. Don't imagine, however, that I will lead you to its temple by the paths of virtue. When one chooses this path, dear girl, one must be prepared to undertake more than one trade and be party to more than one intrigue. So make up your mind, because we are not safe in this cottage and must leave in a few hours.
Oh, madame, I said to my benefactor, I have great obligations to you, and far be it from me to wish to avoid them. You have saved my life, but I find it horrendous that this was done by committing a criminal act. Please believe that, if I had been the one to commit it, I should have preferred to die 1,000 deaths than to have suffered the agony of taking part in it. I am aware of all the risks I have run in following those honest instincts which will always remain in my heart, but however thorny the path of virtue may be, I shall always prefer them to the dangerous attractions of crime. There are religious principles in me which, thank heaven, will never leave me. If Providence makes my life's journey difficult, it is to reward me for it in a better world. I am consoled by such hopes, which may give succour to sorrows, relieve my suffering, fortify me in my distress, and give me the strength to endure all the ills that it will please God to send me. This joy would immediately be extinguished in my soul if I were to soil it with crimes, and in addition to the fear of retribution in this world, I would face the painful prospect of punishment in the next, which would not leave me with a single moment of the peace I desire.
Such absurd ideas will soon lead to the workhouse, my girl, said Dubois, raising her eyebrows. Believe me, you should abandon God's justice, his punishments or rewards to come. All that these platitudes are good for is to make us die of hunger. Oh, Thérèse, the hard hearts of the rich justify the bad conduct of the poor. If their purses opened to serve our needs, if humanity reigned in their hearts, then virtues would flourish in ours. But as long as our misfortune and our patient endurance of it, our good faith and our servitude serve only to tighten our chains, our crimes will become their work, and we would be most foolish to refuse to commit them when they can lighten the yoke which our cruel fate imposes on us. We were all born equal in nature, Thérèse, and if it pleases fate to undermine this first article of the general law, it is up to us to correct such whims and to use our talents to counter the usurpations of those stronger than us. How I love to hear the rich and titled, the magistrates and the priests. How I love to watch them preach virtue to us. It is very hard to keep oneself from stealing when one has 3 times more than one needs to live. A great strain to never think of murder when one is surrounded by sycophants and slaves for whom your will is law. Truly difficult to be temperate and sober when one is at all times surrounded by the most succulent dishes. So difficult for them to be sincere when they have no reason to lie. But as for us, Thérèse, whom barbarous providence, which you are mad enough to idolize, has condemned to the humiliation of crawling along like the snake in the grass, we, who are looked upon with disdain because we are poor, who are treated like slaves because we are weak, we whose lips are moistened only with gall and whose feet tread upon nothing but thorns, you want us to abstain from crime when its hand alone can open the door to life, can maintain and preserve us in it, and prevent us from losing it. You want us to remain perpetually submissive and degraded, while the class that dominates us enjoys all fortune's favours, and our lot is nothing but hardship, despondency and pain. Only want, tears, the branding of the criminal, and the scaffold. Oh no, Therese, no. Either this providence that you revere deserves no more than our contempt, or such is not its will. When you have a better understanding of it, my child, you will be convinced that if it places us in a situation where evil becomes necessary and at the same time gives us the chance to commit it, it is because this evil serves the laws of providence as much as good does and derives an equal benefit from both. It has created us all equal, but he who disrupts this equality is no more guilty than he who seeks to restore it. Both are acting on inborn impulses, and both should follow these impulses and enjoy them.
I confess that if I was ever shaken in my beliefs, it was by the seductive arguments of this clever woman. But a stronger voice than hers combated her sophisms in my heart, and acknowledging it, I announced to Dubois that I had made up my mind never to allow myself to be corrupted.
"Very well," she replied. "Do what you please. I abandon you to your unhappy lot. But if you ever get caught, which is bound to happen, given the fate that inevitably saves the criminal while sacrificing the virtuous, remember at least never to speak of us."
While we were reasoning thus, Dubois's four companions were drinking with the poacher, and as wine disposes the temperament of the wrongdoer to new crimes and makes him forget old ones, no sooner had our rogues learnt of my resolutions than they decided to make a victim of me, not being able to make me their accomplice. Their principles, morals, the dark lair where we were, the safe situation in which they thought themselves to be, their drunkenness, my age and innocence, all of these things encouraged them. They got up from the table, talked among themselves, and consulted with Dubois, actions whose ominous secrecy made me shudder with horror. And as a result, I was finally ordered to prepare without delay to satisfy the desires of each of the four men, either willingly or by force. If I did so willingly, they would each give me one écu so that I might go wherever I desired. If violence had to be employed, things would happen just the same, but in order to preserve secrecy, they would stab me to death after satisfying themselves and bury me at the foot of a tree. I need not describe to you, madame, the effect that this cruel proposition had on me, since you will easily understand it. I threw myself at Dubois' feet and begged her to be my protector once again, but the dishonest creature merely laughed at my tears.
"Oh, fancy,"
she said to me.
"What a sad girl you are! I can't believe that you tremble at the prospect of having to serve four tall, handsome boys like these, one after the other. Are you aware that there are 10,000 women in Paris who would give half their gold or their jewels to be in your shoes? Listen," she added, however, after some reflection, "I have enough influence over those rascals to obtain a reprieve for you, on condition that you prove yourself worthy of it." "Alas, madame, what must I do?"
I cried in tears.
"Tell me. I am ready." "Follow us, join our gang, and commit the same crimes without the slightest repugnance. This is my only price for saving you from another fate."
I did not think I ought to waver. In accepting this cruel condition, I was running new risks, admittedly, but they were less urgent than the present ones. Perhaps I would be able to defend myself against those to come, whereas nothing could protect me from those currently threatening me.
"I will go anywhere with you, madame,"
I said immediately to Dubois. "I will go anywhere. I promise.
Just save me from the fury of these men, and I shall never, ever leave you.
Boys, said Dubois to the four bandits, this girl is one of us. I am receiving her into our gang, and I beg you not to subject her to any violence. Let's not put her off our profession before she's even started. You can see how her age and looks can be useful to us. We should exploit them to serve our interests and not sacrifice them to our desires.
But the energy of passion reaches a certain point in men when nothing can control it. The people I was dealing with were no longer willing to listen. All four men surrounded me, devouring me with their eyes full of fire and threatening me in a manner still more terrible, on the point of seizing me and sacrificing me to their lusts.
She's got to have it, said one of them. We can no longer give a quarter. Is it not the case that one must prove one's worth to be in a gang of thieves, and won't she be just as useful to us dishonored as virgin?
You will understand, madame, that I am softening the language used, and my descriptions of these scenes will be similarly toned down. Alas, their obscene nature is such that a more graphic account would make you blush at least as much as it would my innocence. Alas, poor timid victim that I was, I trembled with terror and barely had the strength to breathe. On my knees before the four men, I stretched out my feeble arms in supplication to them and to Dubois in turn.
One moment, said one of them,
who went by the name of Ironheart and who seemed to be the gang leader, a man of about 36 with the strength of a bull and the figure of a satyr.
One moment, my friends. It is possible to satisfy everyone, since this little girl's virtue is so precious to her, and since, as Dubois quite rightly says, this quality may prove necessary to us if we handle it in a different way. Let us leave it intact. However, we have to be satisfied. We are no longer in our right minds, Dubois, and in the state we're in now, we might cut your own throat if you stood in the way of our pleasure. Thérèse must instantly appear as naked as the day she was born, and she must agree to adopt in turn all the different positions that we require of her, whilst Dubois will calm our ardour, burning incense on the altars to which this creature denies us access.
Take off all my clothes, I cried. Oh, heaven! What are you asking of me? When I stand naked before you, who will be able to guarantee?
But Ironheart, who seemed in no mood to compromise further with regard to my requests, called me names and struck me so brutally that I realized that obedience was my only option.
Dubois, having been thrust into the same disorderly state as I, he placed himself in her hands, and as soon as I was in the state he wished me to be in, on all fours, which made me look like an animal, Dubois cooled his fires, expertly guiding a sort of monster towards the peristyles of both altars of nature in turn, such that with each thrust she had to strike these parts hard with her hand, like the battering ram at the gates of besieged towns in days gone by.
The violence of these initial attacks made me recoil. A furious Ironheart threatened me with harsher treatment if I shrank from this one. Dubois was ordered to redouble her efforts, while one of these libertines held me by the shoulders, preventing me from collapsing under the shocks which became so rough that I was battered and bruised, though I could not escape any of them.
"To tell the truth," stammered Ironheart, "if I were her, I would prefer to open the gates than to see them battered down in this way. But as she does not wish to, we won't fail to make her capitulate. Vigorously, Dubois, vigorously!"
And the explosion of this debauched man's passions, almost as violent as a thunderbolt, died away at the threshold of those orifices which, though molested, remained intact. The second man made me kneel between his legs, and while Dubois satisfied him like his companion, two activities completely preoccupied him. One moment, in a very nervous fashion, he would strike my cheeks or my breasts with the flat of his hand, and the next,
His impure mouth would soil my own. My face and bosom immediately became crimson red. I was in pain. I begged him to stop. And his eyes streamed with my tears, irritating him further, and he redoubled his efforts, whereupon my tongue was bitten, and both rosebuds of my bosom were so bruised that I recoiled in pain. But I was held fast. I was pushed back onto him, and as greater pressure was applied from all sides, his ecstasy was ensured. The third made me climb onto two chairs set side by side with a gap between them, and sitting underneath, and excited by Dubois, who was positioned between his legs, he pushed me down until his mouth was opposite my temple of nature. You cannot imagine, madame, what this obscene mortal had the temerity to request. Whether I wanted to or not, I had to indulge in the lesser functions. Dear heaven, how depraved must one be to derive a single moment of pleasure from such things? I did what he wanted, and inundated him. My total submission induced a delirium in this vile man that nothing else would have brought about without this infamy. The fourth man attached ropes to all those parts to which it was possible to do so. Holding the bundle in his hand, he sat 7 or 8 foot away from my body, greatly excited by Dubois' caresses and kisses. With me standing upright, it was by pulling hard in turn on each of these ropes that the savage stimulated his pleasures. I swayed and kept losing my balance, whilst he was in ecstasy whenever I stumbled. Eventually, he pulled on all the ropes at the same time in such an irregular fashion that I fell over beside him. Such was his sole aim, and my forehead, breasts, and cheeks were covered with the proof of a delirium which this mania alone induced. This is what I suffered, madame. But my honour, at least, was respected, if my modesty was not. A little calmer now. These robbers decided to leave, and that very night they arrived at Le Tremblay, on the way to the Chantilly Woods, where they hoped to pull off a few good strokes. Nothing could compare with the despair that I felt at having to accompany such people, and I resolved to abandon them as soon as I could without risk. The following night, we slept under haystacks on the outskirts of Louvre. I wanted to have Dubois protect me and to spend the night beside her, but I got the impression that she preferred to spend it on business of her own, rather than preserving my virtue from the attacks I feared. Three of them surrounded her, and before our eyes the abominable creature gave herself to all three at the same time. The fourth man, the leader of the gang, came up to me.
"Beautiful Thérèse," he said to me, "I hope at least that you will not refuse me the pleasure of spending the night with you."
And as he noticed my extreme repugnance,
"Fear not," he said. "We'll talk together, and I won't do anything against your will." "Oh, Thérèse," he continued, putting his arms around me, "is it not sheer folly for you to imagine that you can remain pure in our company? Even if we agree to let you, how could that be reconciled with all of our interests? My dear child, there's no point in hiding it from you. When we're living in town, we intend to dupe men, using your charms to trap them."
"Well, monsieur," I replied, "since I would certainly prefer death to such horrors, how can I be useful to you, and why won't you let me go?"
"Of course we won't, my angel," replied Ironheart. "You must serve our interests or our pleasures. It is your misfortune that imposes this yoke upon you, and you must submit to it. But you know this, Thérèse. There is nothing in this world that cannot be accommodated. So listen to what I am saying and determine your own destiny. Agree to live with me, my dear girl. Agree to belong to me alone, and I shall spare you the sad fate that awaits you."
"You want me, monsieur, to become the mistress of..."
"Go on. Say it, Thérèse. Say the word. Of a rogue. That's what you mean, isn't it?" "You're right. I admit it. But I cannot offer you any other rank.
You will understand that our sort cannot marry. Marriage is a sacrament, Therese. And as we are filled with the same contempt for all sacraments, we never touch any of them. However, just listen to reason. You cannot avoid losing what you hold dear, and so is it not better to sacrifice it to one man who would then become your protector and support than to prostitute yourself to all?
But do I really have no other choice? I replied.
You do not, Therese, because you are our prisoner. And as La Fontaine said long ago, force is always the most decisive factor. Indeed, he went on, is it not a ridiculous extravagance to attach so much value, as you do, to the most pointless of things? How can a girl be so simple as to believe that virtue can depend on the degree of width of one part of her body? Oh, what does it matter to men, or to God, whether this part is intact or sullied? I will go further, and say that since it is nature's intentions that each individual should fulfil here on earth all the functions for which he or she was designed, and since women exist solely to serve men's pleasure, it is a clear outrage to nature to resist her intentions for you in this way. You would be a useless and consequently contemptible creature in this world. This fanciful good conduct, which others have been absurd enough to tell you was a virtue, and which, far from being useful to nature and society, has clearly outraged both from your childhood on, is nothing more than reprehensible stubbornness, of which a person as spirited as you are should not wish to be guilty. Nevertheless, listen to what I am about to tell you, dear girl. I shall prove to you that I want to please you, and that I respect your failings. I shall not touch that phantasm, Therese, the possession of which pleases you so much. A girl has more than one favour to give, and Venus is worshipped in far more than one temple. I shall be content with the least of these. You know, my dear, near the Cyprian altar there is a dark retreat where love may find a home to seduce us with more energy. This is the altar at which I shall burn my incense. Not the slightest inconvenience there, Therese, because if you're afraid of getting pregnant, that could not happen in such a way, so your pretty figure will never be ruined. The maidenhead that is so dear to you will be preserved without a blemish, and whatever use you want to put it to, you will be able to describe it as unsullied. Nothing can betray a girl on that side, however rough and numerous the attacks. Once the bee has pumped out the nectar, the rose's cup closes once more, and one would never have suspected that it had ever opened up. There are girls who have been pleasured for 10 years like this, even with several men, and have got married afterwards as untouched virgins. How many fathers, how many brothers, have abused their daughters or sisters in this fashion, without these girls becoming any less worthy of being thereafter sacrificed on the marriage altar? How many confessors have taken this very same road to satisfaction without the parents suspecting anything? In short, it is the refuge of mystery which good conduct combines there with desire. What more need I say, Therese? That temple is both the most secret and the most voluptuous. There alone can be found what is needed for happiness, and the great ease of the temple next door cannot compare with the piquant delights of a place that is reached only with effort and where one is lodged only with difficulty. It even benefits women, and those that reason obliges to acquaint themselves with such pleasures never miss the other kind. Give it a try, Therese, and we shall both be happy.
Oh, monsieur, I replied, I have no experience of such things. But I have heard it said, monsieur, that this deviation you advocate offends women in a manner that is even more painful and offends nature even more grievously. The hand of God wreaks vengeance in this world, as Sodom has shown.
What innocence, my dear, what childishness, continued this libertine. Who taught you such things? Give me your attention for just a little while longer, and I shall set your thinking right.
The loss of the seed intended to propagate the human species, dear girl, is the only crime that can exist. In that case, if this seed is placed in us with the sole purpose of propagation, then I grant you that it is an offence to turn it away from its object. But if it can be demonstrated that, in placing this seed in our loins, nature's aim is far from being propagation alone, what does it matter, Therese, whether it is lost in one place or another? The man who changes its object in that case does no more harm than nature when it makes no use of it. Now, do not these losses of nature which we have only to imitate take place in many cases? The very fact that it is possible for them to happen is a first proof that they do not offend against nature. It would be against all the laws of equity and the most profound wisdom which we recognize in all of nature's works to allow anything that offended her. Secondly, these losses are affected 100 million times a day by nature herself. Nocturnal emissions, the uselessness of seed when women are already pregnant, are these losses not sanctioned by her laws, and do they not prove that, perfectly insensitive to whatever might be the consequences of that fluid to which we are crazy enough to attach so much value, she allows its loss with the same indifference with which she brings it about each day? Do they not prove that while she tolerates reproduction, it is far from always being her intention, that she wants us to multiply, but that since she gains no more from one of her actions than from another that is contrary to it, the choice that we may make is indifferent to her? That giving us the power to create, not to create, or to destroy, we neither please nor offend her more in selecting from one or other of these options the one that will suit us best? That the one we choose, being the result of her power and influence over us, will surely always please her far more than it will risk offending her? Oh, believe me, Therese, nature is far less concerned about those mysteries which we are foolish enough to worship. Since she allows us to burn our incense at any temple we choose, our sacrifice cannot offend her. The failure to reproduce, the losses of the seed that serves reproduction or its extinction, and even when it has germinated, the destruction of the embryo long after its formation, all of these things, Therese, are imaginary crimes which are of no interest to nature, and which it makes mock of, as it does of all our other institutions that frequently offend instead of serving her. Ironheart was getting worked up as he exposed his perfidious ideas, and I soon saw him in that state in which he had scared me so much the day before. In order to make the lesson more effective, he immediately wanted to put theory into practice, and in spite of my resistance, his hands strayed towards the altar which the villain wished to penetrate. I am bound to confess, madame, that I was blinded by the enticements of this vile man, and by giving some ground, I was pleased to have preserved what seemed to be the most essential of things. I considered neither the inconsistencies of his sophisms, nor the risks to myself. Since this dishonest man was hugely proportioned, and so was not even capable of serving a woman in the least criminal manner, driven by his inborn wickedness, his sole aim was to cripple me. I was so fascinated to see all of this, I say, that I was on the point of giving way, and by dint of virtue becoming a sinner. My resolve was weakening, and, already master of the throne, this insolent victor was intent on occupying it, when the sound of a coach was heard on the highway. Ironheart instantly abandoned pleasure to attend to duty, summoned his gang, and hurried away to commit more crimes. Soon after, screams could be heard, and the triumphant villains returned covered in blood, their arms full of booty.
"We must leave without delay," said Ironheart. "We have killed 3 men, the corpses are lying on the road, and it is not safe for us to stay here any longer."
The spoils were shared out. Ironheart wanted me to have my share, which amounted to 20 louis, and so I was forced to accept it. I shuddered at having to take such an amount. However, I was given no choice, and so each took his share and we departed. The next day, we were in safe hiding in the forest of Chantilly. Over supper, the gang calculated their profits from this last job, concluding that they had not even made 200 louis.
It really wasn't worth committing 3 murders for such a small sum, said one of them.
Calm yourselves, my friends, Dubois replied. It wasn't for the money that I encouraged you to show these travellers no mercy. It was for our own safety. These crimes are the fault of the law and not ours. As long as thieves are executed the same as murderers, they will always kill. Since both offences attract the same punishment, why refuse to do murder when it can cover up theft? In any case, the horrible woman continued, what makes you think that 200 louis are not worth 3 murders? The value of everything must be calculated only in relation to our interests. The extinction of each of our victims counts for nothing compared with us. It surely wouldn't matter a fig to us whether those individuals were alive or in the tomb. Consequently, if in such a case we can derive the slightest benefit from it, we should, without any remorse, promote that interest, because where a thing is completely indifferent to us, if we are wise and in charge of events, we should definitely make sure they are profitable for us, regardless of any harm caused to our adversary. This is because there is no reasonable comparison between our concerns and those of others. The former affect us physically, while the latter are of only moral interest to us. And moral feelings are deceptive. Only physical sensations are true. Thus, not only are 200 louis sufficient justification for the 3 murders, but even 30 sous would have sufficed. For these 30 sous would have procured a satisfaction for us which, though far smaller, must nevertheless affect us much more keenly than the 3 murders would have done, the latter having no significance for us. While they are mortally wounded, we do not even suffer a scratch. The weakness of our organs, our feeble-mindedness, the accursed prejudices with which we were raised, the vain terrors of religion or of our laws, all of these things hold back the ignorant from pursuing a career of crime, preventing them from aiming for the biggest prizes. Yet any individual, filled with strength and vigour, endowed with an active and well-organised mind, who puts himself above all others, and rightly so, will be able to weigh their interests against his, scoff at God and men, risk death and despise laws, in the firm conviction that the only interests he need serve are his own. He will believe that the greatest amount of harm done to others, of which he will have no physical sensation, cannot begin to compare with the least little pleasure bought at the expense of the hugest of crimes. Pleasure fills and is inside him, while he is untouched by the consequences of his crimes, which are outside him. Now, I ask, what reasonable man would not prefer what he himself enjoys to what is foreign to him? How could such a man not consent to commit an act, the unpleasant effects of which are external to him, in order to obtain something that to him is most agreeable?
Oh, madame, I said to Dubois, having asked her permission to respond to these dreadful sophisms. Do you not realize that you condemn yourself in what you have just said? Such principles could at the very most suit only that person powerful enough to have nothing to fear from others, whereas we, madame, living in constant fear and humiliation, ostracized by honest people and condemned by all laws, how can we agree to behave in ways that can only serve to sharpen the sword suspended above our heads? Were we not to find ourselves in this sad situation, were we to be in the bosom of society, if we were where we should be, in other words, if not for our misconduct and misfortune, do you imagine that such maxims would suit us more? Can you expect the person who wishes to stand alone in opposition to the interests of others not to perish? Does society not have the right to expel from its bosom those who declare themselves against it? Can those individuals who isolate themselves fight everyone else? Can they truly be happy and tranquil if they do not accept the social contract and do not consent to give away a little of their happiness in order to preserve the rest? Society only supports itself through the constant exchange of good deeds. These are the ties that hold it together. Those who commit only crimes instead of good deeds, and therefore must be feared, will necessarily be attacked if they are the strongest, or killed by the first person they offend if they are the weakest. In any event,
they will be destroyed by the powerful argument that drives men to safeguard their tranquility and to attack those who wish to disrupt it. These are the reasons why it is almost impossible for criminal associations to endure. When the interests of others are attacked at knife point, such people must quickly come together to ward them off. Even among ourselves, madame, I dared to add. How can you pretend to maintain harmony when you advise each individual to pursue his own interests alone? How could you then object if one of us wanted to stab the others to death in order to get his companion's share of the spoils for himself? What finer defense of virtue than the proof of its necessity, even amongst criminals, than the certainty that their unity would not survive for a single moment without virtue?
The fact is, Therese, that all your objections are just sophisms, said Ironheart, and not what Dubois was arguing. It isn't virtue that keeps criminals together, it's egoism and self-interest, showing your praise of virtue to be erroneous and based on an illusory hypothesis. It isn't out of virtue that, considering myself, I suppose, to be the strongest in the gang, I don't stab my companions to death to get their share. It's because I would then be all alone and would thereby deprive myself of the means by which I could secure the fortune that I expect to obtain with their help. This is the only motive that equally stays their hand from striking me. Now, as you can see, Therese, this motive is purely selfish with not the slightest trace of virtue. Whoever is inclined to stand alone against the interests of society must expect to perish, you say. Will he not more surely perish if he has nothing but misery and neglect to live on? What we call the common interest is only the sum of all individual interests added together. But it is only by giving way that these individual interests can agree with and become part of the general interest. Now, what can someone who has nothing be expected to give? If he does so, you will grant that he is all the more in error, in that he is then giving infinitely more than he receives, and in such a case the inequality of the bargain must prevent him from concluding it. Trapped in such a situation, is not the best thing for such a man to do to remove himself from this unfair society? Should he not accord rights only to a different society of men who are placed in the same situation as he, and in whose interests it is to unite their lesser forces in order to combat the greater power that wished to make the unfortunate individual relinquish what little he had for nothing in return? But, you will say, will not this bring about a state of perpetual war? So be it. Is this not the natural state of affairs? Is it not the only one that truly suits us? Men were all born alone, envious, cruel, and despotic, wanting to have everything and give nothing away, constantly fighting each other to pursue their ambitions or defend their rights. The lawmaker came along and told them to stop fighting like this. By conceding a little here and there, we can live peacefully together. I do not criticize the basis of this contract. I simply maintain that two different kinds of individual should never have subscribed to it. Those who, considering themselves to be the strongest, needed to give nothing away in order to be happy, and those who, being the weakest, found themselves conceding infinitely more than they were promised. However, society is made up only of the weak and the strong. Now, if the social pact was bound to displease both the strong and the weak, it must be far from suiting society as a whole, and the state of war that existed before must be thought infinitely preferable, since it allowed each individual to exercise his strength and industry freely, a freedom of which he was deprived by the unfair social pact which always takes too much away from one group, while never granting enough to the other. Thus, the truly wise person is the one who, at the risk of resuming the state of war that reigned before the pact, launches himself with all his might against this pact, violating it as much as he can, in the certain knowledge that whatever profit he makes from these violations will always be greater than what he might lose if he is the weakest, for he was in no better position when he respected the pact. He may become the strongest in violating it, and if the law relegates him to the social class that he wished to leave behind, his last resource is to lose his life, which is an infinitely lesser misfortune than that of living in opprobrium and misery. These, then, are the two options facing us. Crime, which makes us happy, or the scaffold, which stops us from being unhappy. I ask you, my lovely Therese, would you hesitate? Can you come up with any reasoning to match this?
Oh, monsieur, I replied with a vehemence born of a good cause. There are thousands, but should this life be the only object of human beings? Is it not the case that every step in our journey, if we are wise, should lead us to that eternal felicity which is virtue's certain reward? Let us just suppose for one moment, although this is rare and goes against the enlightenment of reason, but never mind, that crime may make the rogue who indulges in it here on earth happy. Can you imagine that God's justice does not await this dishonest man in another world to avenge his actions in this one? Oh, monsieur, do not think that this is not so. Do not believe that, I added in tears. It is the only consolation of the unfortunate in life. Don't take it away from us. If we are abandoned by men, who else but God can avenge us?
Who? No one, Therese, absolutely no one. In no way is it necessary that misfortune should be avenged. The unfortunate believe in this because they wish it to be so, because the idea of it consoles them, but it is no less false. What is more, it is essential that the unfortunate should suffer. Their humiliation and their pain are numbered among the laws of nature, and their existence is essential to her overall plan, as is that of the prosperity that crushes them. This is the truth that must stifle remorse in the soul of the tyrant or evildoer, who should not hold back, blindly committing all the harm that occurs to him, since it is nature's voice alone that inspires these thoughts in him. It is the only way in which she makes us agents of her laws. When her secret promptings dispose us to evil, it is because evil is necessary to her, because she wills it, because she demands it, because the sum of crimes is not complete, as required by the laws of equilibrium, which are the only laws that govern her, and so she demands more crimes to ensure a proper balance. He whose thoughts incline to evil should therefore neither hesitate nor be afraid. He must fearlessly commit the crime as soon as he feels the impulse to do so, for he outrages nature only by resisting it. But let us leave morality aside for a moment, since you prefer theology. You poor, innocent young girl, do you not realize that the religion upon which you base your arguments, being nothing but man's relationship with God, the devotion which the creature believes he owes to his creator, melts into thin air as soon as the existence of this creator is itself proven to be a fantasy? Terrified by the phenomena that they witnessed, the earliest humans had of necessity to believe that a sublime being unknown to them was controlling and influencing events. Weakness lies in giving into or in fearing force. Human intelligence was still too infantile to look for and discover the laws of movement in nature, the only source of all the mechanisms that overawed men, who found it simpler to assume that nature was driven by some motor than to see it as its own driving force. Not thinking that it would be much more difficult to construct and define such a supreme master than to find the cause of the phenomena that astonished them in nature, they accepted the idea of this sovereign being and founded religions to worship him. From that moment on, each nation created a religion in keeping with its customs, knowledge, and climate, and soon there were as many faiths on earth as peoples, as many gods as dynasties. Nevertheless, behind all of these idols, it was not hard to recognize this absurd phantom, the first fruit of human blindness. He assumed different guises, but he was always the same thing. So tell me, Therese, should a wise man renounce the certain and present happiness of this life simply because imbeciles have constructed a pointless chimera and established absurd ways of serving it? Should he, like Aesop's dog, abandon the bone for the shadows and renounce his real pleasures for the sake of illusions. No, Therese, no, there is no God. Nature is sufficient unto itself, and has no need of an author. This supposed author is nothing but the decomposition of its own forces, nothing but what we call in school begging the question. A God presupposes creation, that is, a moment when there was nothing, or else a moment when all was in chaos. If either of these states was bad, why did your God allow it to exist? If it was good, why did he change it? But if all is good now, your God has nothing more to do. Now, if he is unnecessary, can he be powerful? And if he is not powerful, can he be God? Finally, if nature drives itself, what is the point of a moving agent? And if the agent acts to move matter, how can it not be matter itself? Can you conceive of the effect of spirit on matter, and matter being moved by a spirit that is unmoved itself? Just think rationally for a moment about all of the ridiculous and contradictory qualities which the fabricators of this wretched fantasy are obliged to attribute to it, and you will see how they destroy one another, how they mutually devour each other. You will realize that this God phantom, born of either fear or ignorance, is nothing but a revolting platitude which does not deserve either a single moment of our faith or a second of our attention. It is nothing but a pitiable absurdity that insults the intelligence, revolts our senses, a phantom that emerged from the darkness only to sink back into it forever. So don't be concerned by the hope or fear of a world to come, Therese. An illusion which is nothing but the fruit of these early lies. Above all, stop trying to use it to restrain us. We are merely tiny parts of a vile and brutish matter. And when we die, that is, when we are reunited with other elements of the general mass of things, we shall disappear forever, whatever our behaviour has been. We shall momentarily pass through the crucible of nature to re-emerge in different forms, without any greater privilege accorded to those who insanely worshipped virtue than to those who indulged in the most shameful excesses. Because there is nothing that offends nature, and all men have come out of her womb just the same. Having behaved during their lives solely according to her impulses, they will all meet the same end and the same fate at the close of their existence. I was about to respond again to these dreadful blasphemies, when we heard the noise of a man on horseback close by.
"To arms!"
cried Ironheart, who was more concerned to put his theories into action than to consolidate them. We quickly got to business, and a moment later dragged an unfortunate traveller into the clearing where we had made our encampment. Interrogated about why he was travelling so early in the morning on a deserted road, about his age and his profession, the rider replied that his name was Saint-Florent, that he was one of the leading tradesmen of Lyon, that he was 36 years old, that he was returning from Flanders, which he had needed to visit on personal business, that he had little money on him, but a lot of papers. He added that his valet had left him the day before, and that to avoid the heat of the day he was travelling at night, with the intention of arriving the same day in Paris, where he would take on a fresh servant and would conclude some of his business. Moreover, if he was now on a deserted road, he must have taken a wrong turning, having fallen asleep on his horse. That said, he pleaded for his life, offering in return all that he possessed. An examination of his purse proved that this man was the best possible catch. Saint-Florent had nearly 500,000 payable on demand on the capital, a few jewels, and around 100 louis.
"Friend," said Ironheart to him, shoving a pistol butt under his nose, "you must understand that after stealing so much from you, we cannot let you live."
"Oh, monsieur," I cried, throwing myself at the feet of this rogue, "I beg you not to force me to witness the horrible spectacle of this unfortunate man's death when I have only just joined your gang. Let him live. Don't refuse me the first favour I ask of you." And having recourse to the singular ruse to legitimate the interest I was appearing to take in this man, I immediately added with some force, "The name that this gentleman has given leads me to believe that I am closely related to him." Then, addressing the traveller, I continued,
Don't be surprised, monsieur, to come across a relative in such circumstances. I shall explain everything to you. For these reasons...
I continued, imploring our leader once again.
For these reasons, monsieur, grant me the life of this wretched man, and I shall return the favour with the greatest devotion to everything that may serve your interests.
You know what the conditions are if I am to grant you the favour you ask, Therese, replied Ironheart. You know what I require of you.
Well then, monsieur, I will do anything, I cried, throwing myself between this unfortunate and our chief, who was still on the point of cutting his throat. Yes, I will do anything, monsieur. Anything at all, spare him.
Let him live, said Ironheart. But he must join our gang. This condition is indispensable. I can do nothing otherwise, or my comrades would not agree.
The merchant was astonished to hear me claim that we were relatives, but realizing that his life was saved if he agreed to these proposals, he did not waver for a single moment. He was given refreshment, and then, as our people did not wish to leave this place until daylight,
Therese, Ironheart said to me, I call upon you to keep your promise, but as I am exhausted this evening, you may rest beside Dubois, and I will call you at sunrise. If you hesitate for one moment, I shall be avenged for your deceit with the life of this scoundrel.
Go to sleep, monsieur. Sleep in peace, I replied. Rest assured that I am filled with gratitude towards you, and my only wish is to fulfil my part of the bargain.
Such was certainly my intention, but if ever I believed the pretense was justified, it was on this occasion. Far too trusting, our rogues, having continued drinking, soon fell asleep, leaving me completely free beside Dubois, who was as drunk as the others, and soon shut her eyes like them. The moment these rogues fell asleep, I immediately seized the opportunity.
Monsieur, I said to the young citizen of Lyon, through no fault of my own, I was plunged among these thieves by the most awful catastrophe. I execrate both them and that fateful instant that threw me into their path. I most probably do not have the honour to be related to you, having employed this ruse to save you, and, if you agree, to escape with you from the clutches of these wretches. The time is right, I added. Let us go. I can see your wallet. Let us take that, but leave the cash which is in their pockets. It would be too dangerous to take it back. Let us go, monsieur, let us go now. You see what I am doing for you. I am placing myself in your hands. Have pity on my plight, and above all, don't be more cruel than these people. Please respect my honour. I entrust it to you. It is my only treasure, so please allow me to keep it. They have not taken it from me.
I cannot describe the gratitude that Saint-Florent appeared to show me. He could not find the words to express it. However, we had no time for conversation. We had to flee. I carefully removed the wallet and returned it to him. We then hurriedly crossed the copse, leaving the horse for fear that the noise it would make would wake our friends, and as fast as we could reached the path that would lead us out of the forest. We were lucky enough to come out of it by daybreak and without being followed by anybody. By 10 o'clock in the morning, we reached Luzac, and there, fearing no longer for our safety, we thought only of resting. There are times in life when one feels oneself to be extremely rich, though having nothing to live on. This was Saint-Florent's story. He had 500,000 francs in his wallet, and not a single écu in his purse. This reflection made him pause before entering the inn.
"Don't worry, monsieur," I said to him when I saw his embarrassment. "The gang of thieves I have quitted have not left me penniless. Here are 20 louis. Take them, I beg you. Make use of them and give what is left to the poor. Nothing in this world would make me wish to keep gold acquired from murder."
Saint-Florent feigned a sense of propriety which was quite different from that which I was later to deduce from his behaviour, absolutely refusing to take what I was offering him. He inquired what my plans were, told me that it would be his governing law to see them fulfilled, and that all he desired was to be able to acquit himself towards me.
"It is to you, Therese, that I owe my fortune and my life," he added, kissing my hands, "and I can do no better than offer both of them to you. Accept them, I beg you, and allow the god of nuptials to strengthen the bonds of friendship."
I know not why,
but whether because of a presentiment or because of a certain coolness, I was so far from believing that what I had done for this young man could attract such sentiments on his part, that I allowed him to read in my expression the refusal which I dared not put into words. He understood, and said nothing more on the subject, confining himself only to what he might do for me. "Monsieur," I said to him, "if what I have done is truly not without merit in your eyes, the only reward I ask of you is to take me with you to Lyon, and there to find a position for me in some honest household where my modesty will no longer be threatened."
"It's the best thing you can do," Saint Florent said to me, "and no one is better placed than me to grant you this favour. I have dozens of relatives in this town."
And the young merchant then asked me to tell him the reasons why I wished to stay and not to return to Paris, where I had told him I was born. I did so with as much confidence as artlessness.
"Oh, if that's all it is," said the young man, "I can be of service to you before we reach Lyon. You need have no fear, Therese, your case is dormant. You won't be pursued, even less so, I assure you, in the refuge where I intend to hide you away. I have a relative near Bondy who lives in a charming place in the surrounding countryside. I'm sure that she will be delighted to have you stay with her. I shall take you there tomorrow."
Filled with gratitude in my turn, I accepted a proposal that suited me very well. We rested at Luzac for the rest of the day, and the following day planned to reach Bondy, which is only 6 leagues away.
"As the weather's fine,"
Saint Florent said to me,
"I suggest that we make the journey to my relative's castle on foot. When we're there, we shall recount our adventure, and our arriving by this means will draw even more attention to our plight."
Far from suspecting the intentions of this monster, or imagining that I was less safe with him than with the dreadful companions I had left behind, I accepted everything he was suggesting without fear or repugnance. We dined and had supper together. He made no objection whatsoever to my taking a separate bedchamber for the night, and once the hottest part of the day was past, and believing him, when he said that it would take only 4 or 5 hours to reach his relative's house, I left Luzac with him, and we set off on foot towards Bondy. It was approximately 5 o'clock in the evening when we entered the forest. Saint Florent had not gone back on his word for a single moment, still as honest-seeming, still as anxious to prove his feelings towards me. I should not have felt myself to be safer had I been with my own father. The shadows of the night were starting to fill the forest with the kind of religious horror that inspires both fear in timid souls and criminal intent in more ferocious hearts. We were walking along narrow tracks, with myself in front, and when I turned around to ask Saint Florent whether we should really be taking such remote paths, and whether by chance he had taken the wrong turning, and if he thought we would arrive soon, the rogue replied,
"We've arrived, you little whore,"
knocking me to the ground with a blow to my head from his walking stick, rendering me unconscious. Oh, madame, I have no idea what this man then said or did, but the state in which I found myself afterwards brought home to me, only too clearly, the extent to which I had become his victim. It was the middle of the night when I regained my senses. I was at the foot of a tree, well off the beaten track, bruised, bloodied, and dishonored, madame. Such was my reward for everything I had just done for this unfortunate man. After doing everything he wished with me, abusing me in every conceivable way, even in that manner that offends most against nature, the criminal had taken infamy to its most extreme degree by stealing my purse, and with it all of the money which I had so generously offered him. He had torn my clothes, most of which lay in shreds nearby. I was almost naked, battered and bruised all over my body. Imagine my situation in the darkness, without resources, without honour, without hope, exposed to all dangers. All I wished to do was to leave this world. If a weapon had been available to me, I should have had no hesitation in putting an end to a miserable life which had brought me nothing but suffering. "The monster!" I said to myself. What had I done to deserve such cruel treatment from him? I save his life, I return his fortune to him, and he robs me of what I hold most dear. A wild animal would have been less cruel.
Oh, mankind, this is how you are when you listen only to your passions. Tigers in the depths of the wildest deserts would be horrified by your crimes.
These initial cries of pain were followed by a few moments of despair. My tear-filled eyes turned automatically towards the heavens. My heart leapt towards the feet of the master who resides there. That pure and shining vault,